You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Speaking at the University of London several weeks ago, BBC Director General Greg Dyke said that the U.S. media's coverage of the war on Iraq was so unabashedly patriotic and so lacking in impartiality that it had little remaining credibility. He cited Fox News' channel's strong political persuasion and Clear Channel Radio's organizing of pro-America rallies at several of its 1,200 stations across the country as examples of the media's, quote, gung-ho patriotism, unquote. Dyke also warned against British media becoming Americanized. For the health of our democracy, it's vital we don't follow the path of many American networks, he said. More recently, strong criticism of U.S. media coverage of the war was also expressed by Tony Jenkins, a reporter for Expresso of Portugal and president of the UN Correspondents Association. His unexpected remarks came on World Press Freedom Day at a UN forum on the media and armed conflict.
It is our job as journalists to be skeptical, to ferret out the truth that the powers that be do not want to tell us. Most of us take this role very seriously. We see ourselves as the fourth estate, a pillar of democracy, helping to keep the body politic healthy by bringing transparency to the affairs of state. Which is what leaves us so disappointed in the role of the American media in the lead-up to and execution of the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq. As we all know, there is no credible evidence of an Iraqi link to al-Qaeda. But the months immediately after the attacks, indeed, only 3% of Americans identified Iraq as a possible culprit. So how then to explain that today, at least 50% of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein was behind the attacks on 9/11? Could it have something to do with the uncritical way most in the American media reported the statements of the Bush administration that sought to create those links? The outcome of the war appears to demonstrate that the White House embarked on its rather reckless adventure on the wings of a lie. Perhaps the American self-styled exploitation teams will eventually come up with evidence of prohibited weapons programs. But so far, we have as yet to see any proof that Iraq posed any kind of imminent danger to the United States or anyone else. Yet 60% of the American people believed that Iraq did pose such an imminent danger. In this, they were unique. No other nation on earth, including those who have had the bitter experience of Iraqi aggression, such as the Kuwaitis and the Iranians, believed that there was an imminent threat. How did the White House build this majority impression, if not with the compliant help of the American media? It is not that any newspaper or TV program went out there and proclaimed that Saddam was responsible for 9/11. Instead, what they did is uncritically report White House speeches and assertions, which, with an action like a constant drip-drip, finally managed to work their way into the American collective psyche. Take, for example, President Bush's press conference on March the 6th of this year. It was his first primetime meeting with reporters since 1 month after 9/11. At that point, most of the world had rejected the president's argument for war. The economy appeared to be foundering. The evidence of Iraqi links to terror or weapons of mass destruction had not appeared. And yet Mr. Bush was allowed to smoothly slip from mentions of 9/11 to talk of the impending war no fewer than 8 times without a single challenge from the cowed journalists sitting in front of him. They sat meekly there, even when he let slip that the press conference had been scripted. One reporter, April Ryan of American Urban Radio Networks, went so far as to ask, and I quote, "Mr. President, as the nation is at odds over war, how is your faith guiding you?" Frank Rich at the New York Times described this question as, and again I quote, "A God-given cue for Mr. Bush to once more cloak his moral arrogance in the verbal vestments of humble religiosity. My faith sustains me because I pray daily," came the president's reply. "I pray for peace, April. I pray for peace." Far be it from Ms. Ryan to ask a follow-up question about why virtually every religious denomination in the country, including Mr. Bush's own, opposed the war. Indeed, no one attempted to ask a question out of turn, nor a follow-up question. No one raised their voice. No one gave the president anything other than a softball question. As Ian Williams, a former president of the UN Correspondents Association, wrote recently, President George Bush was treated with as much deference as King George III. There have been a few shining examples of media that have resisted this role of faithful echo chamber to the White House. One thinks of the New York Times, for example. But for the most part, the US media, especially the broadcast media, have been pretty disgusting. Either they were willing participants in a cynical exercise that they knew would boost their ratings, or they allowed themselves to be manipulated. As another colleague recently wrote, just ask yourself how many images US audiences got to see of Iraq's population in the weeks and months leading up to the war. Virtually all material that was broadcast involved US military preparations. Like all rights, if you do not use the freedom of the press to its full, it will wither. And I fear that, to some extent, that may be what is happening in this country, as we see dissenters to the government line being accused of being unpatriotic or of being traitors, even. The American media, especially the broadcast media, seem to have come to worship power, and that is not a recipe for protecting true freedom of the press. There is another aspect which I find deeply troubling, which is the contempt shown by so many in the American media for the democratically expressed opinions of so many nations. 85% of the French people oppose this war. Yet according to the American media, their government was supposed to ignore this majority view. The Turks, God bless them, who are struggling slowly towards liberal democracy, held a vote in their parliament which rejected the multi-billion dollar American offer to persuade them to allow American troops to use their territory. This vote, which reflected the views of nearly 90% of Turks, was met with howls of outrage in the American media. Governments, it seems, are supposed to override their obligation to their voters when Washington comes knocking. Finally, we come to the difficult issue, which I suspect is going to be the subject of discussion ahead of us, of journalists who were in bed with the US troops. One has to admire their courage and their professionalism, of course. But boy, were they played like a musical instrument by the Pentagon. Kenneth Bacon, who was the last Pentagon spokesman, wrote in the Wall Street Journal recently and approvingly, and I quote again, you couldn't hire actors to do as good a job as the press has done from the Pentagon's point of view. Ladies and gentlemen, history may yet prove that the British and American invasion of Iraq was a good idea. But I doubt that the history books will be so kind on the job that we in the media have done. If we members of the media do not use these freedoms to their full, and if we do not do a better job of informing the public, then freedom of the press will become circumscribed.
Tony Jenkins is the president of the UN Correspondents Association. He spoke at a UN forum on the media and armed conflict. Special thanks to Peace Watch correspondent Susan Wood for preparing that piece. Anita Cole is a woman of intense convictions. That's what prompted her to trade in her high heels and pinstripe suits for army boots and khakis. Cole gave up her promising career as a public relations consultant in Boston to serve her country. During a conversation earlier today with Peace Watch, she describes what a rude awakening she received in the military culture.
Since I was about 8 years old, I always saw the military as a very meaningful and shared public effort. So after I went to college, I worked for a year and I was enjoying my life quite well. But I still had this sense that I needed to give back to my country, and I never appreciated that the rights that we all enjoy are often defended and protected by people who enlist in the military because they have no other choice, rather than because it's a conscious decision. So I, after college, I remember calling my father and telling him that, you know, I needed, this is something that I needed to do. And my family, you know, did, my family, friends, did everything they could to try and talk me out of it. You know, saying, you know, you have a great job, you enjoy what you're doing, why would you want to, why would you want to do this? But it was something that I really thought was important. And at that point, actually, before I went into the military, I, in fact, believed in compulsory military service. I thought it was something that everybody should do.
Hmm.
And so it was just a matter of me living up to what my expectations were for myself.
And so one day you just went in and signed up?
Well, it didn't quite go like that. No, actually, I had gone and spoken to the recruiter a few times. I knew that, of course, it was something I wanted to do, but there was going to be some work on how I got in there. For example, I wouldn't probably end up doing certain jobs, and I knew that I would want to do something that didn't waste. I had originally intended to go in for, you know, I didn't know how long a contract would be, but I didn't originally intended to go in for 3 or 4 years. And then after that, I always thought that I would, you know, after that first enlistment, I would go off to officer school. I could have gone in right away, but I really wanted to have the enlisted experience.
And so what were your feelings about the issue of war and killing prior to your joining the Army?
Well, I believe, like, you know, many other people who go into the military, I wasn't a person, I wasn't looking for an opportunity to go kill people. You know, those people typically aren't allowed into the military. They're considered unfit for military service for mental reasons. No, actually, I had some general feelings against killing, but I felt that in certain circumstances it was unavoidable, justifiable, you know, and necessary, war being one of those circumstances.
So you signed up. Can you talk about the events that you went through in your basic training that obviously helped to shape your consciousness or your thoughts or your perspective around that?
In basic training, it was very, you know, rude awakening. It was something, you know, things like when you're using a bayonet, what is the spirit of the bayonet? To kill, kill, kill without mercy. And these are the things we say over and over again, or what makes the grass grow? Blood, blood, blood makes the grass grow. But you, like, these are certainly things that I had not gone around saying my whole life prior to that. So.
And these are things you were saying in basic training?
Oh, yes. These are things that people, you know, that every basic training person shouts over and over and over again.
What makes the grass grow?
Blood, 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 blood.
So that helped to bring it home for you, I would imagine.
No, actually, at that time, I was just like, oh, okay. Well, I wouldn't have, you know, come to that on my own, you know, that was what made the grass grow. I would have thought something like Miracle Grow. But no, so I thought, all right, well, this is just the warrior spirit. This is something that's necessary. And if called to war, I will also embrace this warrior spirit. And so, I thought this is, you know, a necessary part of the transformation.
You were prepared to be the warrior.
Yes.
You were prepared to kill.
Yes.
Because you felt it was times when it was unavoidable, justifiable, and necessary.
Correct.
Okay. So how did you move from fully embracing the warrior spirit into deciding that maybe you weren't a warrior after all?
Mm-hmm. Well, it happened. It happened. You know, there were a few key incidents that brought about that huge transformation and crystallized my objection to all wars. It started when, well, my job for the military is a I'm a Caucasian woman, but my job for the military was that of a Chinese Mandarin linguist. I was a Chinese interrogator. So I remember after I went through Chinese training, I was sent on a sort of work to China. And while I was in China and interacting with the people there, I just really felt like a closeness and a bond. They're very warm people, and it wasn't anything like our instructors had indicated it, you know, it would be about their feelings.
What had they told you to expect?
Well, that they were, you know, it was a country of people waiting to basically descend upon Taiwan. Taiwan, this, you know, democratic society embracing values of freedom, and, you know, China wanting to you know, exercise this hegemonic power over them. Now, so that's kind of, you know, that's kind of where I was coming from when I went there.
This is what your sergeants, your lieutenants?
No, this is something that comes from the instructors more than, you know, civilian instructors and, you know, also the people within the military. You know, just basic, you know, people, they're just, once again, I just really think that the people are just spewing back whatever somebody has told them, that Taiwan is a democracy and they're you know, like a, their brethren that are in danger of losing their, you know, higher form of government.
Mm-hmm. So your job was to do what to the Chinese?
Well, in an event of war, I would interrogate prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm. And so you arrived there and you found out that...
When I went to China, I just realized, I at no level do I feel that these people are my enemy. You know, so that was just kind of like, I was thinking, I haven't met all Chinese people. Maybe I would meet perhaps the People's Liberation Army personnel and find that I felt, you know, that they were very much deeply an enemy of, you know, mine or my country.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, I just didn't have that sense. So when I came back, I went to training. That was kind of the first thing, but that's very minor. Later, about, I would say, maybe 3 months later, I went to firing at the indoor range. Every year, a soldier has to qualify on the M16 rifle. That particular day when I went to qualify, a couple of things happened. I wasn't checked. I hadn't fired in almost 2 years, well, since basic training at that point. And when I went to fire, I didn't have hearing protection in this indoor range. And so I ended up in a fetal position at the base of my rifle.
Anita Cole did not qualify at the range that day. Tomorrow, in part two of our profile of Anita Cole, she recalls how a visit to Hiroshima had a life-altering effect on her military career. Today's New York Times reports that the U.S. is now pressing the International Atomic Energy Agency to declare Iran in violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. For an analysis of the situation, we go to Simin Royanian, a Kurdish-Iranian economist and the co-founder of Women for Peace and Justice in Iran. Addressing participants at the End of the War Network's fourth National Grassroots Organizing Conference on Iraq, held in College Park, Maryland last weekend, Royanian gives an economic analysis of the United States' position and ambitions in Iran.
The Middle East is a mirror reflecting the crisis of the world capitalism and the plan of the U.S. government to dominate the world. So I don't believe that there is a crisis only in Middle East or Asia or Islamic countries. There is a world capitalist crisis because the expansion of capitalism has reached its peak, so much so that today it is not possible for the rulers and the ruling class of the rich nations to expand their population and their consumption of the resources of the world without tremendously decreasing and taking away from the rest of the people of the world. While up to now the capitalists simply had to expand, to exploit more, to increase their rate of profit. today, the capitalist crisis makes it impossible for them not to go to war. And in this crisis, the various capitalist classes in various capitalist countries are in competition. After the fall of the Soviet Union, United States imperialism came up on the top. It became the only superpower, and it is the empire. And the interest of the ruling class is, and the Republicans and any other ruling class of America, whether in a party or not, their combined interest is to continue keeping their preeminence in the world economically and militarily. This plan is many years old. After the embargo of 1973, the Kissinger plans were set up. The plan was implemented by Carter, by Reagan, by Clinton through the war in Yugoslavia and the upkeep of the sanctions against Iraq. And now it has gotten to the point where the imperialists of this world are going to dominate the world through their military preeminence. And it is quoted in all of their plans, and specifically in the PNAC plan. Iran is next, or the second, or the third in line, because the Middle East is the most important element in this dominance of the world, because the Middle East provides the main resource which gives the dominant power to control the military in the world and the markets and the consumption and the industry of any other country in the world. So this is like the Second World War. United States government today is the fascist government of Germany, and it is in competition with the other capitalist countries, the same way that the Nazis in Germany wanted to rule the world. Today, United States of government wants to rule the world, and its main competition is not with Middle East, but is with the other capitalist countries. But in order to control Europe, Japan, China, and any other capitalist country, America needs to control where the resources come that gives them the possibility of expanding, and that is the oil resources, and that is in the Middle East. So their plan is complete control of Middle East, and now that they have completely occupied Iraq, the most important country left there, which is not under their influence, is Iran. Senator Bob Graham on TV last week, I was talking to the ambassador from Syria, and he said the real danger is Iran, because Hezbollah is supported by Iran, which possesses weapons of mass destruction. So they are now preparing the portion of the American society to support their next war intervention in another country, Iran. Bob Graham said, oh, Syria is not that important. And Iran, in addition to the oil resources, it is geopolitically very important because it has the biggest access to the Gulf, where the oil has to be shipped to Europe and everywhere else. And also, Iran at this point, historically and politically, is very important because still the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which was victorious in this anti-American imperialism at the time, is still upheld by many of the Muslims around the world who want to work against United States of American government. So it is very important for the United States of government today to defeat the Islamic Republic of Iran, the same way that they said with the fall of the Soviet Union in 1989, they said that socialism and communism is no more the ideology that people of the world want to use in order to be liberated. They want to tell the people of the world that Islamic ideology, we defeated that too. That's why they are going to interfere in the life and government and self-determination of the people of Iran and the territorial integrity of Iran. They have been interfering just as they were doing with Iraq. 2 months before the war on Iraq, they invited all the opposition groups to Saddam Hussein, including Ayatollah Hakim, the ideological leader of the Shia in Iraq. Ayatollah Hakim has lived in Iran for the last 20 years, and ideologically, he is in affinity with the rulers of Iran. And from there, of course, he has promoted his movement the same way that Ayatollah Khomeini was an exile in Iraq and expanded its movement from there against the Shah. Now, the United States government went an envoy to Tehran to invite Ayatollah Hakim to come to Washington to discuss that. The same people today say that the Iranian government is interfering in the matter of establishing a government in Iraq because they are sending trained Shiites to Iraq. But those Shiites who are going to Iraq are the exiled Iraqis that were in Iran for 20 years because they couldn't live there because of Saddam Hussein. Islamic government, of course, would like to have influence in the Middle East. But more than anything else, it is interested to support the territorial integrity of Iran today. It has been very careful in responding to America not to clearly and directly interfere in the matter of Iraq. The United States government today is accusing the Islamic Republic of Iran of all forms of possessing weapons of mass destruction. And it's interesting that militarily, 2 days ago, Rumsfeld said that now that we have finished with Iraq, we do not need to keep all the soldiers where they are. And we are going to move them to the bases for our next action. And you know where they moved them from Saudi Arabia? To Qatar. You know where Qatar is on the Persian Gulf? Right across Bushehr Port in Iran. It's very small. They face each other. And that is where the Iranian government has its nuclear power plant. And they are going to bomb it. That's one of the options. And they are considering all their options.
Simon Royanin is a Kurdish-Iranian economist and the co-founder of Women for Peace and Justice in Iran. She spoke at a forum entitled Iraq Invaded, Implications and Strategies for the Peace Movement, which was part of last weekend's National Grassroots Organizing Conference on Iraq, held in College Park, Maryland. Thanks to Matt Bradley, Avishay Artsy, and Reem Kathuda from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington for preparing that segment. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adil Hamid of KPFA, Yaron Gita, Keith Shaljian, Adam Campy, and Benta Berklin. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for their generous financial support over the past several weeks in response to our urgent appeal. Thanks to your support, Peace Watch will continue to be broadcast. If you'd like to continue to support Peace Watch, you can make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.